I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Thought we'd talk a little bit about the U.S. sending forces into West Africa, not to fight anybody in particular, but to help fight a disease. Jim, who did they send? What is the reason they sent them, and what are they doing there while they're in West Africa?
Well, they sent several thousand American troops who were trained in, you know, medical areas, mainly to, they weren't all specialists, but basically they knew how to handle containment and, preventive measures. And they were there basically to reinforce the depleted African medical personnel who were dying off or just running away because they didn't have the protection, or it was chaotic. And they helped everything from, treating people with Ebola to basically burying the dead, which, because of burial customs over there, caused it to spread. People would touch, the dead body, who was, normally buried quickly because it's a tropical area. But still, you were expected to touch, and that's the last thing you want to do from somebody who's died from Ebola, because the virus is still alive, as it were, after the patient has died.
Austin, one of the things that's happened since we sent them over and is that now a quarantine policy has been put into place. Could you tell us a little bit about that, what the thought process is, and is it a normal thing for the Army type of thing for the Army to do, or the military to do?
All right, let me just talk about the military quarantine policy, which is, as of the day we're doing this, as I understand it, is a 21-day restriction to a restricted and monitored area, and I believe it's actually on the U.S. Air Base at Vicenza. The troops that have that's what I read earlier in the week, but then this morning I got read a piece about what the soldiers and other military members, because there are some other services participating in it, will be expected to do during their 21-day quarantine. Dan, fundamentally, this is common sense. To do this with soldiers coming back from a mission like this. Let's give Al and Nofi a little push on this, and Jim as well. They've both written about what diseases do to military units, and particularly prior to the 20th century, disease would ravage deployed units, and it's like having another battle. It's the natural disease was natural disaster of a type that savaged your forces, and that's why some of the classical requirements on making sure the barracks are absolutely spotless. One of the, even though they're the talk about Alexander the Great saying you can't have a beard and cut your hair so that the enemy can't grab you and your hair on this, cutting your hair and keeping your hair close cropped, of course, got you a better seal on your gas mask in World War I, but it also reduced the threat of lice and diseases borne by insect vectors. Didn't get rid of it, but it was a common sense response to an understanding that there were disease and vector threats. So, and looking at this from a military readiness perspective, and from the point of view of senior officers and senior non-commissioned officers who want to protect their soldiers, you want to treat your soldiers coming back from a mission with respect, but you also have to respect the threat that they met when on that mission. And that, in this case, is this Ebola virus, which There's still, Dan, a lot of uncertainty, and yes, I am taking, I think, a very defensible position on this, uncertainty about the latency period of the virus, how long it can remain active in an individual who was directly exposed to it and got not just exposure, but has the virus in his system. And there is still some uncertainty about how it can be transmitted. So the U.S. military's decision, and the Secretary of Defense Hagel reinforced this in a decision earlier this week, is when you come out of the hot zone, you go into quarantine. And it's quarantine. The medics and doctors are looking at you to make sure that you don't have the disease, because, first of all, we want to take care of you, the service member that did the service, but secondly, we don't want you transmitting it to anyone, particularly other soldiers, because that has a troop safety and ultimately a national security. There's a national security risk to it, and that's why this is common sense. It's a good decision, and the Department of Defense is doing what it needs to do.
Now, Jim, Austin mentioned that you and Al had written a little bit about how diseases affect armies. Can you give us some good examples?
The British and the French sent over 100,000 troops to the Caribbean over a couple centuries, and most of them died there very quickly from the tropical diseases. On the same subject, the Europeans basically had to stay out of Africa until some effective medications were discovered, like quinine, for malaria. Now, the other thing that Western countries developed was public health practices, like clean water, you know, keeping the sanitation, the toilets separate from the water supply, keeping the camp clean and what have you, keeping the food preparation clean, keeping utensils clean. You know, things we take for granted now, but in many parts of the world are still unknown. And people just say, well, it's the will of Allah, the gods, whatever, that we're dying from these intestinal diseases, which could easily be prevented. So in the ancient times, the more disciplined armies lost fewer people to disease simply because they tended to be neater, for want of a better term. And this included doing things like latrines separate from the water supply, which were more cultural than scientific. Nobody understood, you know, the relationship. Although they did understand that if you got close to someone who had a disease known to be very contagious, you would get sick as well. They didn't know about germs. That didn't come until the 19th century. But it was cause and effect, which they could figure out. And that's why you get some of the stories, which apparently many were true, where when one army was besieging a city and a communicable disease, be it measles or whatever, broke out in their camp, they said, well, let's not give this up. Let's fire some of the dead bodies into the city and let them suffer as well. Sometimes it was done deliberately. Even when your troops weren't sick, you would get some bodies, wrap them up tightly, who had died from some communicable disease, bring them in, put them on your catapult, and fling them into the enemy. That occasionally worked. But in the 20th century, well, late 19th and 20th century, when disease was understood, armies and cultures, societies, became deliberate about, you know, avoiding disease. For example, cholera and typhus and other waterborne diseases did not die out in the United States until the early 20th century, and that's a direct result of modern sanitation systems being installed, water and sanitation separate and what have you, because now everybody understood, and the public was willing to spend, you know, a lot of money in order to build these facilities. And that is the primary reason for the nearly doubling of the average lifespan in the last 100 years in the West. and almost as much, you know, other parts of the world. Just public health, what we now call common sense. But, you know, before the 19th century, late 19th century, you know, it was considered mumbo-jumbo. So the biggest problem you have in Africa to this day, especially with this Ebola outbreak, is a lack of popular support for what we consider, you know, good practices, you know, in terms of public health. I mean, there is a better understanding of clean water, you know, keeping the sanitation away from the water supply, what have you. But a lot of people in Asia and Africa, South America, still don't completely grasp that. And that's why you still get outbreaks of disease. Now, the military, even though they tend to be, you know, modern military, tend to be, you know, disciplined and cleaner, they can still spread disease. And there's a well-founded fear of that. For example, not so many years ago, peacekeepers from, oh, I forget where it was. I think it was from Nepal. Were in Haiti, of all places. Haiti had never had a cholera outbreak. A cholera is your typical waterborne disease. You're basically, you know, if sanitation gets mixed up with water and somebody's got cholera, everybody gets it and a lot of them die, even though it's fairly easy to cure, if you know what you're doing. But the cholera proceeded to spread like wildfire because, again, it was a population that had never experienced cholera before, and thousands died, even though there was medical, you know, personnel there, you know, willing, ready, and able to jump on it. And that's why you have the, for example, peacekeepers are now running into problems. If they're coming from a country that has any Ebola whatsoever, they're not welcome. So Somalia is losing some of its African peacekeepers because they're coming from a country that has Ebola or is near a place that has Ebola. So a lot of it's psychological. But the one thing you have to remember that gets lost in all of this, that Ebola is not a big killer. The biggest killer in Africa still is, by a long margin, malaria. AIDS is a distant second, and Ebola, you know, hardly shows up on the same scale, you know, on the same chart, so to speak, showing deaths. The problem with Ebola is it's got a high death rate. It's very difficult to cure, even if you have the resources. Although, as our President Obama pointed out, you know, 7 of 7 Americans who have caught it have been cured, which again shows you what, you know, modern medicine, not medicines per se, chemicals as it were, but simply practices, you know, keeping the patients clean, keeping them hydrated, you know, basic stuff. That's what basically has cured, because anybody who's in good shape and is getting clean water and clean food and what have you has a good chance of beating Ebola, and that's what's happening. And that's why so many people are dying in Africa, because not only are they doing things that make it easy to catch it, but there's not enough people and knowledge there to cure a lot of the people who do have it. So anyway, it's become more of a terror disease than a real disease, you know, that can spread rapidly and kill a lot of people. It's nothing like the influenza of 1919, 1920, which killed, you know, 20 or 30 million, we're not even sure, but it was a lot, even in the United States. Or like SARS, or, you know, the avian, the flu is still a big killer, much bigger killer than Ebola was in any year. So a lot of it's psychological, and a lot of it, the cure and preventing the spread is just common sense, but things that are not common sense everywhere in the world, especially in West Africa.
Oh, Jim, what do you think about civilians coming back being in a 21-day quarantine? Does that make sense?
Well, now, you have one problem you have when your population accepts public health practices is they will basically hug them for dear life, so to speak, if there's a new communicable disease. So recent surveys of the public, the general public on this issue, indicate over 90% say yes. You know, what's the big deal? About 21 days. That's what we have. There are laws on the books for that. You know, the old story about Typhoid Mary, you know, in the 19th century, early 20th century. She was one of those rare people who could carry the typhoid virus but wasn't affected by it, you know, a carrier, as it were. And they had that throughout her entire life. They were kept trying to keep her locked up because, and she liked to work as a cook, which was the perfect way to transmit it. So, you know, she's ended up spending most of her life, you know, in quarantine. But the public, general public says, do it. Now, a lot of these health professionals coming back, like the woman in Maine, the nurse in Maine, yeah, they're a health professional. They're obviously well aware of the disease, the symptoms, or what have you. But so was the doctor who had it. And so were the two nurses who were treating the Liberian fellow down in Texas, you know, who got it. And they didn't, you know, basically the instant they became, you know, symptomatic, in other words, able to spread it by kissing someone or whatever, they did not instantly pull themselves out of circulation. And that's the real fear. So that's why the laws are on the book. Now, the nurse from Maine wants to go to court and make a court case out of it. But I suspect the judge is going to look at this, and the judge also looks at the history of quarantine and these public, you know, health laws and what have you. And he'll basically probably say, gee, I'm sorry, nurse. We respect your efforts and what have you. But, you know, the law is the law, and it makes sense. You know, you're out of action for at that point, it's probably going to be moved because it'll probably be more than 21 days. But if she gets an emergency hearing, she'll probably just say, hey, you know, go and basically stay out of circulation for another 2 weeks or whatever it is. Yes, you're probably one of the rare people who would not, you know, develop symptoms and spread it. But, you know, the law has to apply for all. There's no procedure in the law to determine who is wise and skilled enough to, you know, self-diagnose a disease like this. As Austin points out, we're not entirely clear on all the aspects of it. For example, one of the scariest things to be recently discovered, I haven't been able to nail down if it's actually absolutely true, but in men who are cured of it, their sperm retains the virus. Not the body as a whole, but just the sperm. And, you know, this sounds like an old wives, you know, tale, one of those horrible things about men women say, but when they're not talking to men. But anyway, in this case, it appears to be true. So it means, you know, for weeks or whatever, until that particular system unique to males, you know, is flushed, as it were, recirculates, it's not safe for somebody who's a male who's been cured of AIDS, not showing, you know, his blood is tested and it's not there anymore. It's not safe for him to have any sex. Now, that's what Austin was talking about. Well, maybe not that specifically, but unknowns. As the old saying goes, it's the unknown unknowns that are going to kill you. And this is literally right. True with something like Ebola. Something else I think we should point out right now is that Ebola is not new. It's been known medically for over 50 years. The reason why it came to the attention of the West was because when the Europeans went into Africa in the 19th century, one of the things they did was build roads and railroads. Because up until that time, most of Central Africa, even to this day, you know, New Guinea, tropical area with a lot of hills and valleys, and had thousands of isolated pockets of humanity who did not communicate with each other. I mean, they were literally isolated. They never seen a white man. They never seen people from other tribes, which, you know, were maybe, you know, very, you know, within a day's walk of where they were. The diseases like Ebola and AIDS, for example, were there, but especially the Ebola, which is a fast-acting disease, when you got it, you know, the local people knew, all right, leave him alone. You know, he's got the whatever they called it in that particular area. It was, you know, it was endemic, as it were, to several areas in Central Africa, isolated areas. But once they started building roads and people were able to travel, again, because of the 21 days it takes to develop, people would get on a train or get on a bus or a truck or something like that, go to some other place. And there they get sick, and there somebody would touch them or what have you, and you have an outbreak. But the thing was, fear of the unknown, as it were, especially from people who were strangers. You know, your family was obliged to lay hands on, you know, the dying or the dead, as it were. But absolute strangers, no. You know, you could get buried, and that was it. It never spread. But as the roads and the railroads, and especially cheap air flight, you know, proliferated in Africa, it became possible for several people with Ebola to get into a major city and to start dying and be there with family members and what have you. So you can see the pattern, how that developed. And that's what happened in three countries in West Africa. In Nigeria, for example, they stamped it out. They had an outbreak. And that's America is criticized. You know, hey, we got more cases than Nigeria. The Nigerians basically had learned from the British, like many governments there, were former colonial, European colonial regimes. But one thing they learned was a lot about public health. And the people, the Nigerians running the Nigerian public health, operations, they said, look, gentlemen, we know what this is. We know what the drill is. Let's do it. And the Nigerians did it, and bingo, Ebola's gone. So it's a terrifying disease, but it's not an invincible disease. And, you know, it's the old saying, you know, the old American saying, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
excuse me. Austin, let's wrap this up by talking about what the political situation is in these West African countries and their ability to contain this disease and how effective our troops are going to be in that environment.
All right. Well, that Dan, that's a very good question. Can you hear me, Dan?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Some reason I lost you all for a second. Great question. Let me comment on something Jim said about the transmissibility issue. Actually, Jim, the virus resident in male sperm issue is something I had thought about. It's not the only one. Again, there are. This is what makes the discussion in popular media and in the politicized components of the discussion here in the United States so difficult, is that you do have, unfortunately, we had some very senior members of the Centers for Disease Control come out and say, oh, this can't happen and that can't happen. And then you have other doctors, some of them who have had experience with dealing with Ebola, say, well, what do you mean by it can't be transmitted by breath? What about aerosol? And of course, it's how close are you to someone else, and or does that include quote unquote body fluids? There was a debate I even heard on a cable TV show over, well, that it can't be transmitted in saliva, and one of the other medical people says, you know, I'm not 100% sure about that. And that's one of the things you can't make an absolute statement about it. And that's part of why what goes into the assessment, and I'll go back to the Department of Defense decision, which is, look, we've got these troops, they've done it, and we have the ability, the military's got the ability to order people to do it. But the thing is, though, is that for the reports that I've read indicate troops coming back are compliant because they know how dangerous it is, which leads to me trying to answer your question. All right. I've read about the Nigerian response, and it's just as Jim described it. Kenya, and I'm blanking out on the another East African country who also, quote-unquote, quarantined direct flights from West Africa and put into action a more rigorous, or I'll say a rigorous question and inspection routine to try to limit contact with people leaving the area. Interestingly enough, Congo. And if you follow our Congo and Central Africa updates, which Jim and I have been doing since really 1999 on Strategy Page, you'll recognize that the Kinshasa government is one of the most incompetent on the planet. But the response that they had to Ebola when it broke out in four little villages in an area northwest Congo, we actually had a report on this, I'm going to say three or four weeks ago, they isolated those villages. Now, they didn't cut them off and say somebody can't go in there. Trained healthcare people, workers, could, but they were not going to let people leave that zone until they were sure that the disease had been contained. And I look at this as common sense, and as Jim said, some of the roots of that, and they looked at what colonial governments would do, but that's, again, there's a common sense response to it. I see what the U.S. military doing is not imitating directly what Nigeria is doing or the other West African governments. They are taking common sense organizational health responses, which have a public health dimension to them, Dan. And that's being careful, because even though Jim went through the statistics, the death rate, we're really not sure what the death rate is. You see that 70% figure? It may underestimate it. We don't know yet. You see the numbers that 4,500 people have died in West Africa? It could be 10,000. It could, you could have a, what they call a geometric outbreak. You could. We don't know yet. It'd be fear-mongering to say that some people have engaged in that, saying, you know, we've got this massive epidemic on our hands. We don't know that yet, because there are actions being taken, responsible actions, to limit the spread spread of the disease. But part of the way that you have to respond to it is with caution. And now, what Jim mentioned, or you did, Dan, the nurse in Maine, my own reaction to that, personal reaction, is that she's irresponsible. And as Jim indicated, hey, the law is, if the competent judge looking at it might just tell her that. We have a situation here in Texas right now, and I learned about it this morning on a radio report, of a nurse who returned, a volunteer who returned from West Africa, and she has self-quarantined. She spoke to medical authorities here in the state. She even got a call from the governor, who thanked her for her volunteerism, and her name has not been released. Where she actually lives has not been released, but she says, hey, it's fine for me to sit here in 21 days. I'm going to do it. And so that's a different personal reaction compared to the lady in Maine, and one that I think actually exhibits professional medical caution on her part, as well as an awareness of the potential threat to her fellow citizens. But we don't know her name, you know, and she's staying out of the media limelight, and good for her.
Right. What about the political situation in these countries, Austin? What is it like there?
Oh, okay. In Congo, it's chaotic. If you'll follow, again, our reports on this, the Kabila government is on its way, in my opinion, to creating another president for life situation. Bad. Nigeria is, if you follow Jim's updates on that, there's a civil war going on, basically led by Boko Haram, the radical Islamist organization. So there's chaos and violence. So there's also a lot of oil in Nigeria. In comparison, parts of East Africa, Kenya and Uganda, are much more stable. Sierra Leone, Liberia has not recovered, Dan, from that anarchic, vicious, and violent political/tribal/civil war that plagued it. You'll remember great names like Charles Taylor, when he was the temporary dictator. Jim and I covered, actually, Liberia in the original edition of Quick and Dirty Guide to War. Samuel K. Doe, Master Sergeant Samuel K. Doe. Jim had a funny line, too. It says you can judge countries that are toppled, that run coups, and understand something about how poorly organized they are, or where they stand. Colonels and generals knock off major countries. Liberia was knocked off by Master Sergeant Doe. If that sounds like a put down on Liberia, I thought it was pretty funny when he read it. It was descriptive of Liberia's desperate situation. So you've got in Liberia, a place where they're savaged by anarchy, now savaged by an epidemic. And based on what I've read, I think it's basically the epicenter right now of the worst of this epidemic. Liberia needs help, Dan. And this is gets into a question you didn't ask, but one that I notice has been asked. Is this a legitimate use of U.S. forces? And the answer is, hey, look, the military exists to respond when no one else is capable, quite capable of responding, you know, when something is so severely broken. Now, you think about in warfare, yes, that's combat's your first mission. But then there have been other instances because of the capabilities and capacities that militaries have, aircraft, helicopters, and I'll use as an example the Hurricane Mitch emergency operation in the fall of 1998, 101st Airborne Air Mobile Division helicopters saved, my estimate is, thousands of lives because they got down there soon enough to help with rescue efforts and resupply efforts. That is a emergency response, and the situation in West Africa, look, as long as our troops are trained, they're supplied, and our best job to being able to protect them and prevent them from being exposed to the disease. Yes, a mission like this is a useful mission and an appropriate mission.
Okay. Well, we'll wrap it up there, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Bye, guys.
Indeed. Take care.